Welcome to Voices on Art, the Van Horn Gallery podcast hosted by Daniela Steinfeld. This special episode is produced in collaboration with Independent Art Fair New York City. It will be part of the fair's OVR for its next edition from May 5, 2022 on.
I'm Daniela, and this podcast is about my personal and also about a lot of other people's enthusiasm for art. Art can touch on all parts of life, and therefore we talk about all parts of life. I hope to get you on board and to tell you interesting stories you enjoy listening to. For our international listeners, the podcast will be held mostly in English. We're recording via the internet, so please excuse any glitches and sound quality.
Episode 55, recorded March 11, 2022. My guest today is Frank Maresca, co-founder of Rico Maresca Gallery in New York City, who will be presenting works by the late Indigenous Australian artist Patty Bedford at this year's Independent. Hello, Frank. Very nice to meet you.
Hi, Daniela. Same here. Welcome to New York.
Yes, and welcome to Düsseldorf. Frank, I would like to start at the beginning with your own story. You have a rich life and you traveled many paths, and one was a career in photography. But what's your background and how did art become such an important part of your life?
Boy, how much time do you have? Well, it seems that I've been involved with art really probably almost since I was born, or at least when I was 5 years old. And I guess I was kind of a strange child. I don't know of any other child that for their combination gift, birthday and Christmas present, asked for a 19th century Persian mortar and pestle at age five. And an uncle of mine, you know, who knew exactly what was going on, took me in hand to the Lower East Side in Manhattan from Brooklyn, and took me to an antique shop. And the antique shop was sort of packed floor to ceiling with just about everything you could possibly imagine. And on one shelf, there were four or five 19th century Persian brass mortar and pestles. And he said, pick any one you want. And so I did. And so that was my first artifact, that was my first antique, that was my first work of art.
And so was it collecting, actually, that was the first thing? Because also doing photography is a kind of collecting. It's collecting images.
Well, it is. Photography, of course, came later. Probably at age 12 or so, I kind of became, with first a Kodak Brownie camera, and later an Instamatic camera, I sort of became the family's photographer. So any sort of family event, anything that needed recording, anything that needed memorizing, so to speak, I was the person that was called upon. And photography was just kind of a natural thing for me.
Did you ever think about why it was from such an early age on that you felt so much drawn to these artifacts first and then photography?
Well, I don't really know what makes a collector. You know, probably some of it is genetic and the brain, and other is, as they say, environment. Mm-hmm. And my environment was really influenced by two people: an uncle that I had who had an affiliation with the Brooklyn Museum and kind of took me in hand. He was a collector. I adored him, and so I became a collector, but he died when I was 7 years old. So it just goes to show that all of that which we become actually starts at quite an early age. And then later on, I started collecting just about everything. I collected rocks, I collected fossils, I collected baseball cards, I collected plastic charms, I collected stamps, I collected coins. There's hardly anything that I did not collect. But I never knew really exactly what I wanted to do with my life. And it wasn't until high school that it just goes to show what a great influence wonderful teachers are. And in my senior year of high school, I had a photography teacher, instructor by the name of Bob Burnett, And he really took me in hand and gave me what became the basis of my really true love for what I would call professional photography. And I knew then in my senior year of high school that that was exactly what I wanted to pursue. It was exactly what I wanted to do for a living. The concept of being a gallerist never really occurred to me at all. I continued, of course, to love art, to love photography, but never thought ever of doing that as a business.
I can completely understand that. What was so fascinating in photography for you? Why did you fall in love with it?
Why did I fall in love with it? I think two things. First of all, it was really the only thing that I was good at.
And, that's a good reason, yeah.
I wasn't a particularly good student, and my parents were very practical people. And actually, they wanted me to become a dentist, okay. which I had absolute zero interest in. And when I said that I really wanted to become a photographer, my father said, well, that's a very nice hobby. Mm-hmm. Become a dentist, and then you'll have the money and the ability to pursue anything that you want to pursue, including photography. So I had no interest in doing that. And so at age 17, I left home and moved into Manhattan and supported myself and was incredibly poor and just pursued photography, got a job in a photo studio that did most of their work, which was primarily magazine work, in the evening. A photographer by the name of Irving Schild, who was really my employer and mentor, did a lot of work for Esquire magazine. And for some reason, the creative directors always wanted to come by in the evening. So after school, my professional work day started at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon and generally went until midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning or so. And then I actually lived in the studio. I had a sleeping bag, and I'd roll my sleeping bag out under the skylight in the studio. And that was it. Get up in the morning, go to school, and then come back at 4 o'clock. And my advertising editorial workday would begin.
But that must have been, as a young man, so exciting, and also to meet all these people. So it was a good time, even though you were poor?
It was. In retrospect, Esquire was and still is a really great magazine. Mm-hmm. And I suppose that when I was working with Esquire, the creative directors, fellow Jean-Paul Goud, can't believe that I remember his name, and Jean Loguery, two totally famous, incredibly creative and just great. They were, I believe, co-creative directors of Esquire. And I so enjoyed working with them late into the evening. Now, in retrospect, when I think about it, I suppose then, of course, not knowing what I know now, perhaps I was not completely appreciative of what I was doing. But in retrospect, I look back on it and I look at the photographs that we created late into the night for Esquire, and it's something that will always be with me. Eventually, I struck, like every photographer, I struck out on my own and opened my own studio. I was approached by a magazine that was owned by an ethical pharmaceutical advertising agency, and they desired to start a newsstand magazine, a consumer magazine, by the name of Sexual Behavior.
Wow. Oh, that's interesting. Very open.
It is. It was a magazine, a consumer magazine, as I said, written by doctors and psychiatrists and that sort of thing. And I was 21 years old and they employed me.
You're still so young.
I was quite young. They employed me to be their staff photographer, to illustrate all of the stories. Mm-hmm. And I was 21 years old. I was completely naive. And they said, oh, well, get a studio, get an assistant. get this, get that, and we'll pay for everything. Don't worry, we'll pay for everything. So I proceeded to do all of that stuff, basically under my own name, because a supposed contract that they were drawing up kind of was put off and put off and put off. And in the meantime, I rented a studio and got an assistant.
And you built a career in photography.
Yes, I was shooting for the magazine basically every day. I don't know how many. The magazine lasted maybe for 9 months or something like that. They never paid me. Oh. And it was never a contract. And I was in sort of horrible personal debt. But that was my start, and dragged my portfolio up to advertising agencies and magazines. Couldn't really even afford the subway. So my 30 pound or 40 pound great big portfolio was just carried by from downtown uptown just to save the cost of the subway. And eventually, you know, just sort of plugging away and plugging away and plugging away. Eventually, I started getting $50 jobs and $100 jobs. And then through a whole series of events, I started working for Time Magazine.
Wow.
As a stringer, as a photojournalist, even though photojournalism was really not exactly what I wanted to do. What I always wanted to do was fashion and beauty photography. But that work was incredibly hard to get and incredibly competitive. And so, like any young photographer, I had to take what I could get.
And you had to pave your way.
And I did. And little by little, eventually the jobs got bigger and jobs got bigger and the jobs got bigger. And all of a sudden, I was not impoverished and I was not in debt.
And you became like a successful awarded photographer.
I sort of became a successful photographer and started making some money. And as soon as I started making money, I started buying art. And at first, the art that I bought, of course, related directly to my income, was sort of on a lower level. And then as I started making more money, I needed to or wanted to sell the lesser art that I had bought and buy better art. And I continued that process for a number of years, not giving it any thought. And then one day I was at an art fair, not doing the art fair, but just attending the art fair. And I literally overheard someone referring to me as a dealer. And I was at first puzzled and I said, well, gee, you know, that doesn't sound like a dirty word. And so from that moment on, I started thinking of myself as a dealer, and I started buying and acquiring more work than I could collect for my own personal self.
But it was always the eye of the collector and of the photographer. And a photographer, I mean, this is also a school of seeing. So you were super prepared to see also the good art, because I saw you talking about quality. And so quality is obviously something which is very, very important to you.
Yes, obviously, you know, art is art to me. It doesn't matter at all what form it takes, whether it's dance, whether it's literature, whether it's painting, whether it's sculpture. It's the many facets of art. The only thing that means anything to me really is quality of communication.
Quality of communication. How do you define that?
I define it as going, you know, it's sort of a Star Trek kind of a thing for me.
Oh, are you a Trekkie?
No, I'm not a Trekkie at all. But the mission of Star Trek was, putting gender aside, to go where no man has gone before. In other words, to experience something new, to learn something that previously you did not know. Mm-hmm. When I acquire a piece of art or bring someone into the gallery, it's always about new information. And I judge art according to new information. Whatever I'm looking at, again, regardless of the medium, am I learning something? Am I going somewhere? Am I experiencing something that I've never experienced before? And that is always my rule.
Is that why you were so drawn to so-called outsider and folk art? Because it's probably more directly communicating?
I think direct communication had an awful lot to do with it. It is, of course, non-academic. And so the work that is produced by the artists, these are artists that have no knowledge of the academy.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow that limitation, if you could call it that, really results in art that is very direct without any encumbrance. It's, I don't know if this is really a good analogy, but sometimes I will read one of the major art publications, articles that are written by a scholar, a person of the academy. And I've been an art person all of my life, and I read on and I read on and I read on. And half the time, I don't know what the writer is talking about because it's all so incredibly convoluted.
Mm.
And the ability to look at something and not have any knowledge of art history and have that work of art communicate directly to you without any of the, you know, I hesitate to call it baggage.
I'll call it baggage.
But we can call it baggage. I think that's absolutely wonderful.
Mm.
You know, if I go to, I spend a lot of time at the Metropolitan Museum, and I think I sort of know the Metropolitan Museum inside and out. But it seems that I spend a lot of time at the Rockefeller Benenson wing, which is tribal art. And I look at the works there, and I look at the power of the works, and I look at the directness of the works. And even without knowing a huge amount about African art or oceanic art, still, I'm just always completely blown away by the power. It transports me. It just completely fills me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it enters you in a different way than just mental concepts.
Yeah, and it's different. And, you know, of course, I can appreciate a Cy Twombly or a Rothko and be transported by both of those artists. But somehow that tribal power just grabs me and shakes me. It's something that influences my dreams. It influences my everyday life, strangely, in a way that the academics do not really, or to a lesser extent.
Mm-hmm.
There is that power. I often sort of equate it to watching a terrier, you know, grab a rat and shake it. And there's just something about that moment that is so direct and so powerful and so basic that I just love.
And this is exactly what one would wish art would do to oneself if experiencing it. So it's exactly that. So you became a dealer, a gallerist in exactly that kind of art. But this is also what you want to provide for your clients, I guess, this kind of experience.
Yeah, education is really everything. And I like to think that I spend as much time with students and people who might never be able to afford luxury, the privilege of owning art, mm-hmm. the ability to live with art. But the educational component of it, to be able to convey information, to have people that really want to learn, to absorb whatever it is that I know, I think it's really important to transfer knowledge. Anything that I've become, at some point, I will not be here.
Mm.
In a lot of ways, that's the essence of art. I had another high school teacher tell me, he said, you know, you're dead a lot longer than you're alive.
Oh, true.
And it's true. And I like to think that I think about the future. And when I'm not around, anything that I know, I want whatever I am and whatever I've learned and whatever passion to be able to transfer that to someone else, to a younger brain,
mm-hmm.
and have that younger brain be an emissary It's the continuation of knowledge. It's the continuation of stories. The artist, the two shows that we'll be doing of Patty Bedford, you know, I don't know if I'm getting ahead of myself. It's sort of a good moment, mm-hmm. I think, to talk about continuing.
You will show him also at Independent.
We will be showing a one-person show of his gouaches, the smaller paintings at Independent. And then the very next day here in the gallery, we'll be showing the larger paintings here. And that exhibition will be, I don't know if you could say it's under the auspices of the Australian Consulate, but we've been working with the Australian Consulate, and the Australian Consulate is very much interested in moving Australian Indigenous art forward.
Yes, so Patty Bedford is an Australian Indigenous artist.
Yes.
And he passed away.
Yes, yes, he is no longer living. But I guess what I was really getting into when I was talking about moving, carrying knowledge forward, that is the most important thing to remember about Patty Bedford. It's the most important thing to remember about Australian Indigenous art. It's about storytelling. It's about the past, the very, very distant past. Australian Indigenous culture is 60,000 years old. And the earliest Indigenous rock paintings, which was the first form that the art took, is the earliest found so far, at least, is 17,000 years old. And it's all about stories. It's all about dreams. All of this has been carried forth from the past to the present. It's communication. And it's really quite amazing. This is exactly what Patty Bedford does. His paintings are stylized methods of communication. The Australian Indigenous art was never a written form. Mm-hmm. It was always a visual form. It was a visual form that took place on rocks. It was a visual form that took place on the body. And then really not all that long ago, about 50 years ago or so, it started taking the form of boards that are called Papunya boards. And those boards really were the first transportable form of Australian Indigenous art. They were a form of art that could essentially leave the Australian rural community, the desert, and be carried forth so that the stories that the Indigenous artists was no longer localized. Mm-hmm. And those stories and those dreams could go out to the rest of the world. And that is exactly what happened. And that is exactly what is still happening with regard to artists like Patty Bedford.
And people have also to learn to listen and to read that stories, you know? And so this is actually probably where you come into play, not only as a gallerist, but as a mediator of that stories.
Yes, a gallerist is a guide.
A gallerist has so many functions, you're right.
A gallerist has to be a guide. And while I like to think that the work of any artist, period, but particularly true of Australian Indigenous art and also art from other cultures, from a tribe, art that is non-academic art. As we talked about before, the concept of knowing art history and knowing about the academy in order to be able to appreciate the art is not necessary. Yes, I do function as a guide. And to be honest, at least with regard to Australian Indigenous art and Patty Bedford, I guess you could say I'm guiding myself, because this is a show that I have been wanting to do maybe 20 years or so. And truthfully, I did not know where to start. Australia is a long ways away, and the Australian Indigenous communities, even within Australia, are even further away. And I did not know how to pursue it, mm-hmm.
And how did you then? How did you approach it?
Well, I approached it, you know, I was really kind of at a loss as to how to do this in a way that was a way that would satisfy me in a way that was serious.
Mm-hmm.
So it sort of happened naturally. Two very good friends of mine, John and Barbara Wilkerson, have one of the finest collections of Australian Indigenous art in the world. A number of years ago, they did a one-person show at the Gray Art Gallery here in New York, and they did a book titled Icons of the Desert. And I attended the opening at Gray and looked at the book, and I was just completely taken, mesmerized. But I still really did not know how to pursue this. And from time to time, I would talk to John and Barbara about the concept of doing something in the gallery. Eventually, they introduced me to a gallery in Australia that is one of the leading galleries specializing in Australian Indigenous art by the name of DeLon Contemporary. So about 2 years ago or so, during the COVID epidemic, I started Zooming with DeLon in Australia. It's kind of one Zoom after another, bringing me up to speed, talking about what might be possible with regard to cooperation between our two galleries, and reading as much as I could. And eventually we said, hey, let's do an exhibition together. Let's produce a cooperative exhibition. And then it was a question of, well, who would be the artist? I've always been, particularly with regard to the independent art fair or other art fairs, I like one-person shows. So at first, with DeLon, we started talking about a group show.
Mm-hmm.
And then from the group show, eventually it segued into a one-person show. And we said, you know, who might that person be? So DeLon Contemporary has the estate of Patty Bedford, and Patty Bedford being one of Australia's most important Indigenous artists, and in addition, an artist that has never been shown here in the United States. So that's always a great thing, to be the first. Everyone wants to be the first, and there's a certain excitement to being the first. And I think that this exhibition, because it's never been done, and because there will be two exhibitions, one after another, I'm very excited by it. DeLon Contemporary is very excited by it. And the Australian Consulate is very excited by it.
So you bring the Australian culture into the world?
Yes.
Outside of Australia?
Yes. Australian Indigenous art has gone from really obscurity even 10 years ago or so. The work was known by a few people, but generally, if you mentioned Australian Indigenous art, even to the fine art community, most people would know very little about it. They basically tell you, yes, you know, it's not academic art, it's produced in Australia, and it's produced by the Indigenous people of Australia, but they wouldn't be able to tell you much about it. In the last few years, there have been exhibitions. There was a wonderful exhibition that took place at the Gagosian Gallery. And that was primarily the collection of the actor Steve Martin and his wife, Anne. Mm-hmm. So that was a wonderful exhibition.
It takes, yeah, such a sensitivity and such integrity to deal with these kinds of culturally so important works, you know, which are not coming from academia, which come from another tradition, which goes so far back. How do you keep this integrity in a contemporary commercial art world?
Well, I guess it's a good question. It's a complicated question. For many years, a lot of Australian Indigenous art was not only misunderstood, it was something that was, let's see, how can I put it? things that took place with regard to artists. Artists were taken terrible advantage of, Australian artists. And the great works were essentially copied. And those copies, those inexpensive copies, became what a lot of people came to know of as Australian Indigenous art. If you went to the major cities in Australia and you went to some sort of a very basic gallery or shop, or even at the airport, you would see representations of what looked like legitimate Australian Indigenous art, but basically they were just copies that were churned out and churned out and churned out because they had a certain graphic appeal that people really liked. But the true art that was really the true artists were really not being recognized. And those artists that were being recognized were unfortunately and often taken advantage of.
Mm-hmm. But that changed.
That situation has changed radically. So now with people like DeLon Contemporary, where a portion of the sales go back to the artists and go back to the community, and making sure that abuses of the past are a thing of the past.
So that is also a different storytelling. It's just much more integer and beneficial to the communities.
Yeah, this art is all about community. Community is everything. And as I said, the community is an ancient thing. And the stories that were formulated, really, in ancient times by the community, those stories are carried forth in terms of communication. You might consider the single artist to be sort of a messenger, really, that represents the community. But the stories are a formulation of sort of everything that the community is all about, the history.
I think our storytelling has to change as well. And we have to learn more about community, perhaps. Perhaps we can learn from that artist.
We can learn a tremendous amount. We should be a community in the Australian Aboriginal community, in any community where I think survival has a lot to do with it. And so members of the community are all in cooperation with one another. One person needs another person, needs another person, and it all has to do with survival. That is really what community is all about. Different people bonding together, helping one another, not working as you often find in the cities. Even the concept of competition within a community is virtually unknown. It's really all about support rather than competition. I think any city, you know, whether it's Dusseldorf, whether it's Berlin, whether it's New York City, whether it's Los Angeles, if we were more of a community, and I think that to a certain extent, we've seen that with regard to COVID, you know, so all of a sudden here we had an epidemic that was threatening the entire world. And so the entire world, communities, cities had to all bond together to help one another. This is the sort of thing that, you know, without COVID has occurred in the Australian desert with regard to the Aboriginal community.
Actually, I always thought that the concept of competition is a very destructive one. I think you're right. It should be more about support and about communication and dialogue. So I would like to know, because you are spending all your time since the past, since 1979 as a gallerist, and since you're 5 years old, with art, deeply in the art, and understanding it, and you are in it on so many levels, what does it fulfill inside of you as a person for your personal development?
Well, again, I'm always learning, and that's really everything to me. I'm very much enjoying learning about, and I'm still a complete novice in terms of Australian Indigenous art. I'm not on video, so you can't see that I have all of these notes in front of me, because the Aboriginal language is a different language. And I've always had a problem with sort of long names and pronouncing long names. So here I have all of this information in front of me. And as a result of this call, of this podcast, I am very quickly coming up to speed. Our exhibition is at the very beginning of May, the Independent Art Fair. And even though the process began with DeLon Contemporary 2 years ago, 2 years is really nothing. When I pursue something, I really pursue it wholly.
You learned the Aboriginal language?
No, I would love to learn the Aboriginal language. In reality, for me, that would be completely impossible. The names are very long and very sort of non-Western. And I can't even make my tongue do that. I'm looking at a word here that means dream time, because, and as we spoke about, dreams are so much a part of all of this. And I'll spell it for you here. It's J-U-K-U-R-R-P-A, Jukurupa, and that is one of the very, very, very easy names.
But an important name, because it's all about the dreams.
It is. So Patty Bedford's name, the name Patty Bedford, is a name basically that is anglicized. It's the name that he mm-hmm. goes under. It is not his indigenous name. His indigenous name is spelled N-Y-U-N-K-U-N-Y. I can't even pronounce that.
Okay. I mean, it's good to know and to remember that those names like Patty Bedford, that they are not the real names, and that there is another name, sort of like a more truthful name behind this. But I don't think it's necessary to be able to pronounce it, but to understand that it's there.
Yeah, Bedford came from basically the area that in Western Australia, the Kimberley region that Patty Bedford is from, when the English came in the 19th century to Australia, they called that land Bedford.
So it's a colonial name in a way.
It is a colonial name, and that's where it came from. And so much of what Patty Bedford is about, including his first name, Patty. It was taken from an early 20th century person who operated a railway station in the area. But Patty Bedford is very much about the late 19th century, and the paintings are about the land more so mm-hmm. than anything else. They are, for the most part, I would call them dream landscapes. And I think that that's as good a definition as anything. But in addition to the dream landscapes, Patty Bedford's work is really about an event that occurred in the late 19th century. It was referred to as a massacre. And Indigenous people, apparently because, as the story goes, because a cow was killed, that a village was massacred. So Patty Bedford, it was called the Jumba Massacre, and it took place in the late 19th century.
And he grew up with that stories.
And Aboriginal people were apparently poisoned with strychnine in this. So Patty Bedford has carried this story forward, because Patty Bedford and other artists like Patty Bedford and the community do not want these stories to be lost. It's a part of history. It's a part of history that needs to be carried forward. And it's a part of history that really very much relates to what is happening today with other people who are in other in different indigenous communities.
Or different nations, not even just indigenous, just different nations.
Different nations, different cultures.
Yeah.
You know, whether you're talking about Black history here in the United States or really anywhere in the world.
Or even the people in the Ukraine.
Absolutely.
Right now.
Absolutely. Abuses that have occurred. You really might be talking more about freedom, really, mm-hmm. than anything else, or the lack of freedom.
Yeah, and the other is always like not worth it, or the other is always feared, and so the other has to be destroyed, and that's a story that's happening like since humankind exists, probably.
Completely. I think this exhibition, because of the historical and political aspect of it, is just so incredibly now. It's so contemporary. It is so of the moment. And that has me tremendously excited, being able to take this exhibition, bring it to New York, and talk to people, whether it's vis-a-vis this podcast, or whether it's at the Independent Art Fair, or whether it's in the gallery, or any other media attention. I'm learning, and the little that I've learned so far, I have some ability to carry forth, to act as a sort of a messenger, really, as Patti Bedford's messenger, and to bring this, you know, very contemporary message forward at the beginning of May.
Thank you so much, Frank. Thank you so much for your time. Thanks.
This was a pleasure and fun, and I hope that anyone listening to the podcast finds it interesting and will attend the Independent Art Fair, and the next day will also attend our exhibition at the gallery.
This podcast comes to you for free. If you enjoyed it, we kindly ask you to consider donating to a cause of your choice to support the victims of war in the Ukraine. You find a link to several organizations that provide support to the people in the Ukraine in the show notes. Voices on Art and Independent New York will each make a matching donation in partnership with Ukraine. Thank you. This was a special Voices on Art episode created in collaboration with Independent Art Fair New York. Listen to it on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or the platform of your choice, on our website van-horn.net, and in the Independent OVR at independenthq.com. Follow Independent Art Fair on Instagram at independent_HQ, and the podcast at Voices on Art and at van_horn_Düsseldorf. Thank you for listening to Voices on Art, the Van Horn Gallery podcast hosted by Daniela Steinfeld. Stay tuned and connect.